This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The chrysanthemum throne has moved into a new era, that of Reiwa, which means beautiful harmony. It marks the reign of the new emperor of Japan, Naruhito. Starting today, you can sign a book of congratulations at various offices around Oahu. We invited Deputy Consul General Takayuki Shinozawa to talk with us this morning about what lies ahead.
We have a long history about Japan and Hawaii. As you know, that last year we have marked that 150 years anniversary, the first Japanese came to Hawaii. Then after that, many our imperial family visited here to encourage Japanese working here or making some good relationship. Then last emperor called Akihito, he came here 6 times. He married at 1959, that he's the first emperor married to the common lady in the history, in the long history of Japanese emperor. Then celebrate that marriage. Then here in the Japanese descendant celebrate that marriage. Then they create a scholarship. The name is at Grand Akihito Scholarship Foundation, and it's only one the foundation to name that emperor's name.
And so the whole point of that scholarship is to do what?
Yeah, we select each year one Hawaiian, one Japanese, then exchange that student, then that more deepen that relationship with Japan and Hawaii.
And so how long are they able to stay here to study?
It depends that 1 year or 2 years.
Okay, so that's one long-lasting tie that we have to the emperor who has just stepped down.
Yeah.
And so our new emperor of Japan has never visited Hawaii, though.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, he's never come here. But I hope that he or his wife, the new empress, Masako, she was used to our colleagues in the Foreign Office. That you very much hope to visit in here.
Yes, because, I mean, she was a rising star in the diplomatic circles. She's very well educated. Mm. And I think when people think of modern Japan, that they think of someone like her who has gone abroad to study.
Mm. She studied in Harvard. She can speak a very fluent English. So our office is now, today, just opened that congratulatory signature book for the public until May 10 in our business hour from 8 o'clock in the morning to 11:30, then afternoon 1 to 3:30 in our office.
So folks can just go down there and sign the book. And then when will that be presented to the emperor?
We prepare the book, then that anyone can come there, then making some sign or and written that some congratulatory message or anything.
And I know you folks say no gifts.
No gift we accept.
Yeah, but just simply come down and start the new era off with mm-hmm. your wishes for the new emperor of Japan.
Yeah.
And so people can not only go then to the consulate, but they can also go to the Japanese Cultural Center, correct? There'll be books over there as well?
Yeah, that's some Japanese related organization giving the cooperation with us. And Japanese Cultural Center of Hawaii, they also cooperate. And also that one Japanese society called the Hawaii Senior Life Enrichment Association. And I heard that Okinawans Association, they also have a cooperation to accept the book for the congratulatory message.
Okay, so our community then can go to any of these places, and they can do that until the 14th, 14th, 15th? I guess it depends, but maybe the best thing is to call ahead and check to see.
Yes, please. That our office is at Nuanu area, so that Japanese cultural center is based on the Makiki area. Then Senior Life Association is in his offices in Waikiki.
Oh, in Kalakaua.
Kalakaua. Then Okinawa Association in Waipahu. So that's everywhere that people wish to feeling convenient to sign please visit to sign for the congratulatory message.
Now, with this new era, there's lots of hope. And there are lots of challenges for Japan. What would you say are some of the biggest challenges that the country faces?
Last era, it's called Heisei. It's 30 years. We have so many incidents happen. Also in Japan, we have so many disastrous.
The natural disasters.
We now still in the recovering period, so that new emperor facing that more endeavor or trying to more develop or getting the a kind of common prosperity between the Japanese citizen, so that we that the name of the labor is a beautiful harmony. Then we people gather, then making a good harmony to create a new beautiful era.
Now, I was reading that the new emperor studied, I think, at Oxford.
He's very good at speaking in English. Then he's the first crown prince attending the United Nations Assembly to make a speech on his study in water supplying. And also, he visited in Brazil, then making the same kind of speech in English. And so he has a very good experience and skills and knowledge about such things. Then he's, as you say, that he studied in Oxford, that he's very modernized and internationalized, that we hope that he makes some good contribution or cooperation to the international field.
And so I know this is also a period, you know, post-war. What do you think lies ahead with the relationships internationally?
After the war, we have some difficult period relation with such, particularly recently between China or Korea. But we hope that every time have a good relation with other countries.
Peace and prosperity.
We wish to have, yes.
Beautiful harmony.
Yeah, not particularly in Japan, but in the world. Next year, we are having that Tokyo Olympic. Then maybe many foreign countries, people visiting Japan, that we very much hope to have a good, successful event. And as you know, in Tokyo Olympic, that surfing is that elected the first time for the Olympic Games. That the surfing, I heard that originally come from Hawaii.
Yes.
So it's much fun that Hawaiian people love to come to Japan to observe that game or join or viewing that TV.
Yeah, it's a big event, a big deal.
Mm.
Yeah, so lots to look forward to with this new era and the new emperor.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We've been talking to Deputy Consul General Takayuki Shinozawa about ushering in the new era of Emperor Naruhito Reiwa. You can find details about the congratulatory book signing on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, it took a life of travel and adventure across borders and social classes for Geoffrey Chaucer to be able to write the Canterbury Tales. The first new biography of Chaucer in a generation gives us a fascinating glimpse into the life and times of one of the fathers of English literature. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Honolulu Magazine. The May issue profiles 5 families living in small spaces. More information online at honolulumagazine.com.
Reading the national headlines are enough to give you an ulcer. On the Long View today with Neil Milner, we look at the divide between political parties and how that translates to local politics. Good morning.
Good morning.
You have an ulcer yet?
A continuing discomfort.
Oh, there you go.
That's discomfort. Called national politics. Yeah, so anyway, this is, everybody knows by now how profound the polarization is in American national politics, and we've sorted ourselves by ideology, and we've sorted ourselves by where we live. We don't talk to people. We don't have much contact with the other party. This is pretty much based on national data, and three social scientists decided to see whether this applies to local politics. So what they did was to use surveys and that had been done in eight American cities, fairly good-sized cities, that varied to extent of how Republican the area was, how Democratic the area was, what the economic base is. And they looked at what people who identified themselves as strong Democrats and strong Republicans, or strong liberals, strong conservatives, what they felt about local issues involving economic development. And they found two things. First of all, these people were very different in their views in regard to national politics. But on local issues involving economic development, which is one of the key things that cities do, they were very similar. Conservatives and liberals thought about the same thing in terms of the basic ways that you bring about or that you try to bring about economic development. So that you really do have a difference between how these people think about national politics and how they think about local politics. There was only two issues that there was a significant difference between people who identified as strong conservatives and strong liberals. That was on the role of labor unions. Again, they're thinking about this in the urban, the city context. Right. And the other one was vouchers for charter schools. Those things are particularly significant. Not because they're significant issues, but they say something about why there isn't the polarization at the local level. And the main reason has to do with whether those issues are even national or not. The way that these people describe this is that these two issues are more polarized because they've become more of a national issue. Vouchers and charter schools and all that sort of stuff, and of course labor unions. We get our cues about national issues or issues becoming national. We're more likely as individuals to get our cues from the national parties. That's where we get our stuff, especially as stuff has become more politicized. So part of what they're suggesting is that a lot of the reasons for the lack of polarization on local economic development is because these issues are still localized, and national parties are not interested in making these more national issues.
So I'm always curious, though, when I see national studies about how it applies to our local scene, just because of the two-party system, which we don't really have because we don't have two strong parties here.
Well, I give the usual nasty blanket answer, which is that we don't know. And we don't know a whole lot about why things happen in Hawaii and whether they're different and whether they're not different, because we don't have good data. If you want me to say something in a stretch, I would say that you would probably find some of the same patterns. I mean, we do have some conservatives here. I mean, if you look at say, the Trump vote, the Republican Party is in trouble, but it's not non-existent. So you've got liberals and conservatives. And my guess is, and again, it's a guess, is that we would break down about the same way, that there's more consensus about the importance of over how to deal with local issues of economic development than there is on issues involving, let's say, immigration or any of the other things that healthcare, any of the other more nationalized political issues.
Yeah, those are pretty polarizing.
Yeah, and the other thing is here whether we sort ourselves geographically the same way that lots of cities do. You know, that's another question, because remember, this sorting is social sorting just as well.
It's funny because I went in to go get my car worked on, and just conversation going on, between some of the customers that were waiting, and they were just really kind of disgusted with local politics. They were just upset.
Well, there's two ways to look upon that. Part of which is that you get disgusted with it because it's not working very well, but you're paying attention. And that's understandable and good. Unfortunately, what we found in national surveys, and again, it probably applies here, is that people have become less interested in local politics. They know less. Their orientation is toward the national. And so they know less about their candidates, their voting turnout for local elections down. And they talk about national politics all the time. That's a driver. That's the counter movement toward a kind of localism movement that people are disgusted. So they've written it off. I've actually talked about that, I think, on an earlier mm-hmm. show, that really is a trend. And part of that is reinforced by what the national parties do. They don't look for – they're interested in national issues. They're not all that interested in what difference is going on in a local issue, let's say Hawaiian sovereignty or some of the other things that would be different about Hawaii. So that's the other trend now. At the same time, there is this whole movement toward localism that it's actually a movement. And depending on who you are and how you look at it, there's a lot of evidence that there's a whole lot of ferment in certain places around the country that we don't pay much attention to. They're not necessarily the big, sexy coastal Silicon Valley cities mm-hmm. or New York or any of those kinds of things. And James Fallows and Mrs. Fallows wrote a book about this that's very interesting, where they say if you look at the cities, these very different kind of cities, small town cities, there's a whole lot of local cooperation that goes on. It cuts across the ideological lines.
Party
lines, because the issues are pragmatic. So you get, they're trying to get some kind of training program in a school, or they're trying to clean up graffiti. People just work together because they don't see this as an ideological issue.
Right. Can't we all get along?
Well, but it isn't that it's not just can't we all get along. It's not necessarily that these people are nicer. It's joint work. They see something that they share. They don't have a lot of cues from their kind of national focus that are polarized from one another, and they get stuff done. And it may be that in communities, there's a kind of social infrastructure that brings people together that doesn't mm-hmm. work at the national level. Libraries, schools, churches, or whatever, where you're a little bit more likely to interact with people who are different from you and maybe in concrete ways.
Right. Anything else that you think that struck you about the surveys that they did?
Well, I think it's interesting stuff, but that it doesn't say anything about the potential for our national politics to become any less polarized. The forces that are driving polarization there are very strong, and this operates at a kind of parallel level. And you might want to see it as a haven. But all this says is that there are places where people do share ideologies and approaches, even if their national views are different.
Right. And I know it has been kind of at this crescendo, or it just, it doesn't stop. And so sometimes it's hard to watch and keep up with, because it's very stressful and you have to step away.
No, you have to step away. If you're looking for a haven, if you're looking for a place where, as flawed, as angry as people are, you got some kind of potential for, let's call it, sensible problem solving, you might as well turn toward the local, because frankly, that's where your life is much more impacted. It may not be where your emotional life is in regard to politics, but that's the case. And it's a very vulnerable haven because there are things that are working against it.
Okay, and the other remedy would maybe to watch some late-night comedian shows or something.
Well,
lighten up.
Yeah, but here's the thing about late-night comedians. They're speaking, they're preaching to the choir the time. I mean, this is basically anti-Trump humor that's very funny to audiences that will laugh at anything. Yeah.
All right, well, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
Neil Milner is a retired professor of political science and contributing editor of our segment, The Long View. Find out more on our Facebook page, The Conversation, HPR. Thanks.
This week on Says You.
So one of the things I really like about the English language is that words are often polysemous. So can we do all of the above?
Often what?
Polysemous. They have more than one meaning.
Oh.
Yeah. You're thinking polygamous.
Yeah.
A game as fast as it's fun, and everyone's a winner, says you. This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
This morning, Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Anita Hofschneider joins us for today's reality check. She has a deep dive on the water rights struggle on Maui, a hot butt issue in this session. Good morning, Anita.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so, you know, we've been hearing about this for some time, but you spotlighted a couple of farmers that really have a lot of emotion tied to this issue. Their livelihood, really.
Yes, I was really lucky to be able to go over to Maui and to spend time with Edwin and his wife, Mahialani, and go to their farm and learn about their years and years that they've lived there and Ed's family history of farming taro on that same land that once belonged to his grandparents and actually has been in his family for six generations.
Yeah, it's you refer to it as kind of a bittersweet victory, right? The three decades of fighting, the good fight, the way he sees it.
Yes, that was something that was really interesting to me because when I first learned that a 2016 court ruling had forced the release of many streams, including the ones that bring water to his particular farm, I thought that this would be a happy story of kind of victory and sort of what it's like now to grow taro again. And in some ways, you know, it was really positive in the sense that he was really happy to see this work being done on his farm again and the help of his neighbors and local nonprofits. But at the same time, there was a lot of, I think, sadness there about the lost opportunity to pass on his knowledge to his children and, you know, thousands of huli dying, years of lost crops, and just also this difficulty of restarting planting. You know, as you know, farming is difficult regardless, and to be starting it again after years of not being able to farm taro, it's a very arduous process.
And you also talked to his neighbors, too.
Yes, I spoke with other farmers there who also talked about, you know, their challenges with having dry fields for many years. And, you know, one of them said that he ended up getting a job at the county because he couldn't afford to just keep farming. But they were also talking about how this is something that they consider not just their livelihood, but also such an important cultural practice and something that they are really hopeful, you know, they'll be able to continue to pass down to future generations.
Yeah, you know, we've been watching in these final days of the legislative session, which actually ends today, just how divisive this issue has been. And, you know, politically, just a hot-button issue. I know the governor's taken some heat because he was supported by a lot of environmental groups. And then when he called on the last minute to, you know, for the lawmakers to do something to help Alexander and Baldwin out, you know, they were not happy.
Yes, exactly. And as my colleague Chad Blair has been reporting this session, the Senate ended up not having the votes to bring that bill to the floor. And so environmental groups and Native Hawaiian groups are seeing that as a victory, including these farmers. But, you know, I think part of what I realized through reporting this story was that it seems like there's always something happening in this ongoing fight for them. And so there doesn't seem to really be an end in sight after 30 years of Edwin working to get restore the stream water. It's something that, you know, is an ongoing political battle in Hawaii, and it's something that, you know, he'll probably be doing for the rest of his life.
Well, it was interesting to me in reading your article because, I mean, I think covered Mahialani went, you know, with her work with the Native Hawaiian Leaf Corporation, but I didn't know she came from a farming family.
Yes, she actually met Ed when she was representing a Native Hawaiian Leaf Corporation was representing his case. And so they ended up getting married. And so in some ways, the battle has actually brought them together.
Yeah, a very interesting story. Again, very emotional story. We do appreciate you giving us this view, even with all the political turmoil this session. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was reporter Anita Hofschneider with today's Reality Check. Check out her story on civilbeat.org. Well, tomorrow a series of legal experts and climate advocates will gather at the Hawaii State Capitol to discuss the latest effort to address climate change. Cities and states around the country are suing big oil companies over physical damage related to climate change. Ann Carlson is one of the speakers at tomorrow's event. She's a professor of environmental law and works pro bono for the plaintiffs in some of these cases. She spoke with HPR's Ryanfinity earlier today.
I think there are two reasons there's been a rise in lawsuits related to climate change. One is that the federal government has withdrawn from the Paris Agreement and has rolled back regulations that the previous administration had proposed and had implemented to cut greenhouse gas emissions. And so the lack of federal policy, I think, is making advocates turn to other jurisdictions, states, courts, et cetera, to try to do something about the problem. But I think the other reason is that a number of lawsuits have been filed by cities that are alleging that oil companies are causing climate change and creating damages already. So we're already seeing sea level rise, beach erosion, increase in hurricane intensity, increase in wildfires, droughts, et cetera. And those are turning out to be enormously expensive problems in addition to being dangerous to public health and, you know, problematic for all sorts of reasons. They're really expensive, and municipalities don't have the resources to try to fortify their seashore, if they're coastal communities, to protect against skyrocketing temperatures, to protect elderly people by providing cooling centers, to battle wildfires, to pay for all the damages from wildfires, droughts, et cetera. And so they're looking to try to figure out who should pay. And I think the answer to who should pay for many municipalities is the companies that caused the problem.
And so what exactly are these lawsuits alleging? Who did what and who was harmed?
So a series of cities around the country and one state, the state of Rhode Island, have filed cases under what's known as public nuisance doctrine against the major oil companies that extract and then refine products that contain lots of carbon, so principally oil. And the idea is that these companies have been selling a product that emits greenhouse gas emissions and doing so in ways that harm municipalities and their residents. So again, through sea level rise, which is inundating many coastal communities around the country, including places like Imperial Beach in Southern California, which is the poorest beach community in California and is now a plaintiff in one of these lawsuits. They are contributing to wildfires. The California wildfires, of course, of 2019 set records for damages and led to huge numbers of deaths, people inundated by fires who couldn't get out of their homes, droughts, long-term droughts, increasing hurricane intensity, et cetera. And so the cities and the state of Rhode Island are seeking damages for harms that are already occurring as a result of climate change from, again, those companies that have caused a big percentage of the problem.
And why have they chosen the extractors of fossil fuels rather than a power plant or a manufacturer of cars, which produce a lot of emissions, or even the operator of a vehicle that produces emissions? Why ExxonMobil?
Well, I think the reason that Exxon and Chevron and other big oil companies have been sued by the plaintiffs is because they extract so much of the product, the ultimate products that end up emitting greenhouse gases, so that you can trace a huge percentage of greenhouse gases over the past 30 or 50 years to really a handful of oil companies around the world. 28 companies that have ties to the United States are responsible for something like a quarter of all greenhouse gas emissions emitted in the last 30 years.
What's the outlook for these lawsuits and this legal strategy? Because I believe there were some suits in years past that weren't successful.
Yes, there was a round of nuisance cases filed during the early 2000s, and all of them were dismissed before they even got to what's called the discovery stage, where you could go seek evidence against the defendant for various reasons having to do with complicated jurisdictional and constitutional questions. Most of those cases were filed in federal court, and this new round of cases has been filed in state court. And there are really, I think, three reasons why these cases are actually stronger than the first round. The first reason is as we've already discussed, they're against these big extractors of fossil fuels. And so a big percentage of greenhouse gas emissions are connected to the harms that the plaintiffs are seeking damages for. And that's relevant for legal purposes. So you need to, for public nuisance, you need to show that there's a substantial interference with a public harm. And in this case, there is a substantial interference if the plaintiffs succeed in showing that the defendants caused the harm, because a lot of the greenhouse gases that have been emitted by these defendants. But there are a couple of other reasons. Over the past 10 years or so, scientists have gotten significantly better at determining whether particular extreme events like hurricanes, sea level rise, droughts, heat waves, et cetera, are caused by increasing greenhouse gas emissions. We call this attribution evidence. So the best example is that scientists now know and can show that there is a linear relationship between increasing greenhouse gases and increasing sea level rise. There's basically a one-to-one relationship. The more greenhouse gas emissions you put in the atmosphere, the higher or the larger amount of sea level rise we're going to experience. And sea level rise is causing lots of harm to coastal communities, as you know, water surge onto streets and erode beaches and all sorts of things. So that's another reason. And then the third reason is that there is new evidence that defendant oil companies knew about climate change as long ago as the 1950s. And there were lots of meetings, there were reports prepared by the American Petroleum Institute demonstrating that climate change was on the horizon and was going to be a huge problem and was caused by the emissions of greenhouse gases from the burning of fossil fuels. And then the oil companies did two things. The first thing they did is that they funded campaigns to try to persuade the American public and other publics that climate change was not occurring. At the same time, they spent their own resources protecting their own assets against the climate change effects that they knew were going to occur. So, for example, Exxon paid to raise its oil platforms in the North Sea to protect against storm surges that would be increased as a result of climate change. So at the same time, the oil companies were funding this campaign of disinformation to the American public. They knew climate change was occurring, and they were spending their own money to protect their own assets against the very harms of climate change that they were denying.
So what are these lawsuits seeking? Is it simply restitution for damages and funds to be able to make fortifications of existing infrastructure in the future? Or are they seeking some sort of long-term change in the behavior of these large extractors?
These lawsuits are focused on the damages that are occurring and will continue to occur. They're not focused on getting oil companies to change their operations going forward. That's the subject of some legislation, some state legislation, some other lawsuits. But the nuisance cases themselves are really focused on the harms that municipalities and states are experiencing and will experience from climate change.
And when could we expect to see some sort of result or decision in the courts on these cases?
So these lawsuits are slow, and a number of them have been filed and are right now embroiled in a bunch of really technical, wonky legal questions about procedure and jurisdiction. Assuming they go forward, then the next step will be that the municipalities that have sued can engage in what's called discovery. So they can go take depositions of major executives and oil companies about what they knew and when they knew it, about the damages that oil companies themselves have predicted will occur, about the kinds of disinformation that the oil companies engaged in, and so forth. And that will be a long process, probably a 2-year process before we ever get to a trial. But I would guess, you know, at the earliest, we might have a trial in a nuisance case 2 years from now.
All right. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens then. And thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Ann Carlson is professor of environmental law at UCLA and co-director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. She and other experts will be speaking tomorrow from 11:30 to 4:30 in room 325 at the State Capitol.
Aloha, I'm Taimane, all the way from Aina Haina. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
May have a favorite memory of Rap Replinger. His comedy made so many of us smile. He died more than 3 decades ago. Cocaine was found in his system, but questions about his death following a fall nagged his wife. Many remember her as Lisa Clark, former broadcaster for KITV, KHVH, KMAI, and KKON. Out of that unsolved mystery of Rap's death came a desire to get her arms around his life. Lisa joined us for a chat in our studios yesterday afternoon. So good to see you. It's been many years. And I look back fondly at the time that we spent together in the newsroom at KITV.
It was 5 years and a long time ago in the 80s, right? That seems like a world away.
And you're back home for a special reason.
I have written the biography of my late husband, James Kavika Pi'imana Rap Replinger.
And so the title of the book, Paradise to Paradise. It's been a journey.
It's been a real journey. And on the book, it says this is my first book, and I think it'll be my last because I didn't realize how much was involved in writing a book. TV is our thing and radio. But there is a lot involved into putting a book together. I self-published it through Best Press, and they were wonderful to work with. And you ask about the title. The title came from the fact that I know that Rap is in heaven. We lived in paradise here in Hawaii, and he went to paradise. So that's where the title of the book comes from.
And it must feel good, though, knowing that you've got this published.
You know, after him being gone for 35 years, it's just amazing how much people still love him. Of course, I still love him. But to have that shared aloha with the entire state of Hawaii and other places that people have migrated, he has fans so many places. John DeMello gave me the reins to his Facebook page, and there are nearly 9,000 people who have liked it. And I put up the Auntie Maria Lani skit from Raps Hawaii about a week ago, and it has a reach of over 23,000 people, and over 200 people have shared it, and you know, people commenting and people just love Rap.
Yeah, it must be fun to read what they're saying and their memories, really.
Yes, yeah.
And so, in addition to the book, you are re-releasing some of this material.
Yes. The last 3 albums he did with Tom Moffat have been out of print on vinyl. There were these 3 albums that were released in 79, 81, and 83. And then they were on cassettes, you know, back then in the 80s. And then in the 90s, Tom Moffat released them on CD, and since then they've been out of print. And so one thing led to another, and now we are releasing these albums on iTunes, and the date of the release is next Tuesday.
Okay, well, you talked about Auntie Maria Lani. Let's take a listen.
And now, Cooking with Auntie Maria Lani.
Aloha. This is Auntie Maria Lani, and will you stop that whistling? It's driving me nuts. Thank you. Hello, this is Auntie Maria Lani, and welcome to Auntie Maria Lani's Cooking Hour. Today, we're going to learn how to make a very, very special and exotic dish with chicken. It's called chicken a la Wanda de Cuesto de Porta e Mauna Kea, and it serves 8 to 10 people or 1, depending, of course, upon their appetite. Now, what you're going to need is these ingredients: chicken, celery, potatoes, and wine. Now, you must make sure that your wine is not too sweet, not too rancid, but just right. Okay, let's check the wine. Not too sweet. Oh, not too rancid. Oh, it's just right. And now we're ready to begin. Now, take out your chicken and gently massage its breasts, making sure that your wine is not too sweet. Not too rancid. Oh, no, not rancid. It's just right. Okay, now, butterfly.
Oh, I just love that bit. It's Auntie Maria Lani, cooking show number two.
And the people who, a lot of people know that catchphrase, not too sweet, not too rancid, but they don't know where it came from, you know. But people who have memorized that skit from Raps Hawaii will notice that it's different than what's on the television show. But this was the debut of the Auntie Maria Lani character on this album, Do I Dare Disturb the Universe? And so for the first time that since 1979, this album is in its entirety with these other two albums. And people can, we have a website, raprepplinger.com, and go there and link to that. And you can also order the book on there and see stories about rap and video clips. A lot of the people I interviewed, I rolled video on them, and we have clips on there.
Because you and I work together, and we know we often have so much material that it's very hard to edit down. I'm sure you must have had a heck of a time doing that.
Well, one of the things about writing this book was, as you know, in television, you have to think about the visuals all the time. And this book has so many stories for which there is no B-roll. And that was a luxury, to be able to tell these stories and not have to worry about, oh, I don't have anything to go with that, because it's a book. And a lot of never heard before stories are in this book that just haven't ever been told in public.
Well, what made you decide to do a project like this?
Well, the genesis really was when KGMB in 2011 did a life story on rap, and they called and wanted to interview me. And so I started on this journey not knowing that it was going to be a book at the beginning. And the first thing that I did was all of these questions came back to me that surrounded Rap's death. And it's kind of been a mystery. And I'm not the only one who wonders what really happened that day up on Mauna Willy. So I started looking into that, and I found some pretty surprising answers to those questions. And once I discovered that, I realized that that story needed to be told, but it needed to be told in the context of Rap's life and his humor, which, as you said, people still really love to this day.
Right, and then you have talked to people and included so much more, like you said, in this book that most people don't know the backstory, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Share some of the things that maybe jumped out at you as you were doing all this.
Well, I dedicated a whole chapter to Raps Hawaii and interviewed Larry Fleece, who is the producer and the director of that show. And Billy Sage was one of the only people who had a speaking line in Raps Hawaii. And I take it skit by skit and look at what was going on in these skits behind the scenes. For instance, Secret Taste Test, and that's a bit that was on Strange Bird, one of the albums that we're releasing. And Billy Sage was in that, and that's the one people will remember the phrase, "I like the cracker." So it's the tester's trying to get him to choose between two sodas, and all Rap's character wants to do is eat the cracker. And at the end, they're fighting over these crackers, and Rap falls on the table, and Larry would yell cut, and that was it. And they kept doing it over and over again. And meanwhile, the Channel 9 crew's coming in going, pretty soon we need to set up for the evening news with Bob Seavey.
The serious stuff.
They were on a tight schedule the whole time, but they're like, you guys need to hurry this up. And so they had time for like one more take. And they're fighting over the cracker basket again. Rap falls on the table. It split down the middle. They did not rig it to split. It split. So that's the take that you see in the show. And Billy, he told me, he's like, I had this moment of terror. I didn't know what to do. And then I realized the camera's still rolling. So he drops the mic on Rap, and then he walks out.
Oh, that's just so Billy.
Yeah, yeah. And what about the mic drop? You know, people do that now. And this was like in 1981. He does a mic drop way ahead of anyone else.
It just must have been so fun, though, to connect with people again as you're putting the material together, and they're just coming back on this trip to kind of present the book.
I've seen so many people that I haven't seen in years, and met a lot of people through this. You know, friends of Rapp's at Punahou School. I got to know so many of those. Of course, I always knew his best friend from Punahou, Mark Sklov, is a dear friend. And he connected me with these other buddies. And then in that chapter, you see his sense of humor developing and already doing multi-character routines to crack up his friends. And then we also look at Booga Booga, the theatrical comedy group that he was in with Ed Kaahea and James Grant Benton, and their role in the Hawaiian Renaissance of culture that took place in the early 70s. They had a big role in that and set at Territorial Tavern downtown. So I talked to, interviewed many people, including the owner of Territorial Tavern, what that place was like, and just moved through his life from that point. And speaking of Ed, he is coming over from Kauai to be at the Hawaii Book and Music Festival. We're doing a presentation on Saturday afternoon. Going to play a video clips, and Ed will be there with John Osorio, and John DeMello was going to join us until when he accepted the invitation. He said, "My dad's not doing too well." So, since his dad did pass this week, Kitty Iannone is going to step in. She's the CEO of Communications Pacific, known as Compaq now. She's been helping me with publicity, and she is really a blessing. She is keeping my head on straight during this book launch. But Kitty was in a comedy group, an improv comedy group that Rapp put together in 1982 called Hats. And now she's this high-powered PR person. But back then, she was Kitty Dudley, a mom with two little boys driving around in a Volkswagen bus, and went to these auditions because she was taking a class at UH, and they said, if you try out for Rapp's comedy group, you'll get an A. And she didn't even stop because there was this big line, and they were interviewing people in line from television stations. She turned her bus around and went home. And then the next day she had another chance and he cast her.
Right. Well, I think she shared part of that story last time she was here for Pledge Drive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But no, this book, you know, wonderful stories, wonderful memories. The last chapter, you do talk about Rapp's death.
Well, there is an ongoing investigation into Rapp's death with the Attorney General's office, because they're looking back, looking at the... One of the big questions that is astounding that HPD detectives never seem to consider was Rapp there by himself. And someone has made a sworn statement to the Attorney General's office that says, yes, this is an alleged scenario. Yes, there were other people there with him. And he didn't fall on his own. Let's put it that way.
Right, so he may not have been alone up there in Manawili.
That's right. And I showed the police reports to a nationally known cold case expert, and the first thing that popped into his mind, the first thing he said was, I would swab his shirt for touch DNA. So he looked at it and immediately thought, there's a strong possibility that this guy was pushed. And that detective, has a national profile. He's solved more cold cases than anyone else in the United States. So his opinion has credibility.
Right. So you're hoping then with the release and the inclusion of that chapter in this book and what you've learned, because you said that you did have some threats that were made.
Rapp was receiving threats in the 2 weeks leading up to his life, at the end of his life, rather. And those were on an answering machine tape. I turned it into police, and somehow that tape disappeared, and there's no record of it.
Right. So the puzzle hopefully will come together. People will read the book, and somebody out there who knows something else may come forward.
That's the hope. That is the hope. That's one thing that this cold case detective told me, that they have a lot of luck putting things out to the public again. People who didn't want to talk back then but are ready at this stage in life to say something now could come forward, and that's the hope. Writing this book, I laughed, I cried, and ultimately, though, I found healing with it. And I dedicated the book to Raps fans, and I hope that they find the same in the book, that they find some humor and some healing.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's great to see you again.
It's good to see you. And look for Lisa on Saturday on a panel at the festival starting at 3:30. And to check out the video, the stories, and the info on how to order the book, Paradise to Paradise, you can go to rapbuckner.com. You can also link to Rap's last three albums on iTunes and CD Baby. Lisa Clarkstone tells us that proceeds from iTunes will be shared with Rap Sisters. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we talk about your family treasures and how to care for them. It's a call-in show. We gather the experts in our studios to answer your questions as we come off National Preservation Week. Tell us what's on your mind, call or talk back line, and leave a comment. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation, Hawaii Talks.